Welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are in your ears, thanks to OldFootballShirts.com. Well, last weekend we travelled to Liverpool and came unstuck at the Toffees as some absolutely woeful defending and our inability to take a set piece saw us lose 4-2 at Everton. Also this week, the first transfer window closed as it saw us add two Polish starlets to our ranks in the shape
of
Jacob Moda from Lech Poznan and Mikhail Karbonik from, or Karbonik as I like to call him, from Legia Warsaw, both of whom have been loaned back until at least December. Tudor Baluto has also been loaned out to Dynamo Kiev, where he'll be playing against Barcelona in the Champions League. But we don't want to talk about any of that, as today we are joined by a man who is part of the furniture, really, and is to planning what Zamora is to goals, and without whom it would be very difficult to imagine where the club would be now. Now, in the biggest ruse since the Trojan horse, the club have allowed him to retire, although myself and certainly Alan Wares really don't believe it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Albion Roar, Martin Perry.
Hi, everybody.
How are you, Martin? You're right. It's good to see you. You're looking well.
I'm good, thanks. I'm very good and enjoying this so-called retirement.
How is retirement? Well,
just run that past me again. I think I'm still working 9 till 6 most days of the week, but no doubt it will click in at some point. I think it's real this time. We've had several attempts at it before.
What do you mean this time? You make it sound like Frank Sinatra's sort of like, you know, 37th comeback that you've actually had to go through. I mean, if you're just trying to say, Tony, I'm retiring, and he's saying over my dead body, and now finally he's happy to cut the strings.
Well, you know, I'm 73. I think it's about time that I tried to achieve it. So there's a real attempt this time to actually achieve it.
Now, listen, we're going to go through. We're going to spend the next hour going through your achievements. You know, and I'm going to say at the top of the show, you are probably one of the greatest people that has ever been associated with the Albion. And there's several within this current era, this epoch that we're going through, who can actually lay claim to that. But you are definitely one of those. So with that in mind, we're not going to quite do a This Is Your Life. You know, we don't do that level of embarrassment. But Martin, ahead of us talking to you about it, thank you so much for everything you've done for the club. And as Adi said at the top of the show, it'd be so difficult to know where we'd be without it. So thank you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. I mean, that your words, and I've had lots of lovely messages, actually, and your words are very, very, they mean an awful lot to me. So I'm very, very grateful.
Yeah. Right, AD.
Okay. Well, let's start with this then. It's well known that you're a keen sailor, and you were due to go sailing one day back in 1996. What would happen if you actually had gone sailing that day?
I did go sailing. I dropped in on Dick Knight and Bob Pinnock and Liam Brady on the way to Southampton to pick up the boat to go, you know, sailing for that weekend. So it didn't disturb that, but it was certainly a milestone in my life.
You see, AD, Martin Perry is an either-or person. He can do both. That is why we are where we are, is because he gets to do both. You thought he was either-or.
Well, unlike the boat, that question sunk. So
it did. Well, not quite up there with Wrexham 2006, but, you know, not far off it.
But, I mean, it was a benchmark day in the Albion history, really. I mean, like the club being formed in the Seven Stars, but you going round to Liam Brady's house to meet.
How did that come about, Martin? Because was it on the back of a phone call from a Hove councillor?
Yeah, it was Ivor Kaplan had found out and heard about what we were doing up at Huddersfield. The Huddersfield project was immensely successful, and the leader of Kirklees Metropolitan Council was a Labour member called John Harman, now Sir John Harman, and great friends with Ivor, and told Ivor about it. And Ivor made contact, and that's when I uttered those immortal words. You know, Ivor, I was brought up in Brighton. I'm a Brighton fan. It's a fantastic club. I'd love to build your stadium, but I don't want to end up running the football club. And 3 years later, I was running the football club.
Be careful what you wish for in life, Martin.
But the key thing there, Martin, is first and foremost, you've always been a fan.
Absolutely. I mean, I moved to Brighton when I was a very small boy. My sister was very, very poorly. And sadly, not long after we arrived in Brighton, she passed away. But my family stayed there, and we lived within sound, not shooting distance, but sound distance of the Goldstone.
You said something
and I can well remember hearing the crowd roaring whenever we scored, and that was my very, very early childhood. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you were in Dyke Road or around that area, weren't you? So, I mean, and as famously said in the Goldstone rap, you can hear the roar from the Seven Dials. So, did you actually write that song?
I can't lay claim to it, but certainly I could hear the roar from the Goldstone, and you could hear it at the top of Dyke Road where I was.
Fair enough. I think Martin's pretty street. He could have had a word in there. I don't know. You know. So you grew up as a Brighton fan. You went to the games in the 60s and 70s before heading off around the world and doing other stuff. And we don't want to sort of like repeat too much as what's gone on the Albion's Own podcast. If you do get a chance, do listen to Adam Ty having a natter with Martin Parry about all things. Certainly Martin's upbringing in his life. It's a very good podcast, and you'll find that on the club website. But what I do want to find out is that, you know, put some more meat on the bone as to what we said, especially when it came to you meeting Liam Brady, Dick Knight and Bob Pinnock for the first time. I mean, they sold you a dream, but when you first met them, did you think, okay, well, this is a dream, or, you know, did this is something that you were sold on immediately?
Well, of course, my upbringing and therefore knowing Brighton and Hove Albion, I think obviously that knowledge played a big part in the decisions that I made at that time and my understanding of the situation. They didn't sell me a dream. What they told me was that they had got a massive problem, and that they were trying to, in particular Dick and Bob, were trying to get control of the club because it was in the hands of somebody who was quite clearly running it into the ground. They needed help. And it was very, very clear that they had absolutely no knowledge of the construction process, the building process, the planning process, and everything that you had to do. And also even the relationships with the council, which of course at that point were at a shockingly low ebb. Mm-hmm. They had no knowledge of that whatsoever. I mean, Dick obviously had a long held love of the Albion and over years and years of following them. And Bob too. And they had the business experience, in running a business, but the sheer process of building a new stadium was just nothing that they knew about. But I suppose it was my knowledge of the club, my knowledge of the city. It was at that stage, it was still two towns, was such that somehow, instinctively, I knew that the club had enormous potential, mm-hmm. and that it was at a very, very low position, but in the wrong position. And I was obviously conscious of the fact that, you know, it had played in the top division prior to that. And now here it was at the very foot, in fact, hanging out of the bottom of the Football League. And it just shouldn't be there. It was in the wrong place. And it was that potential that I could see. But that was because of my previous knowledge of it. I knew a lot about it, which sort of led me to saying to them, right, okay, look, if we work together, we can do this. And they agreed it straight away.
I assume that when did start talking to each other, this was always, at the time you were working for Alfie McAlpine, the contractors, I assume that this was always with a view to having that particular hat on. And as much as you ever said to either captain, don't have me running the club, you know, was there ever sort of that sneaking feeling thinking this is coming my way?
Not at that point. I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. I was wearing my Alfred McAlpine hat and I saw an opportunity to build a new stadium for a great club. And that was why I was invited down, and that was why I, was there. It was only later, it was quite a bit later actually, when we were building with Dean, or we'd gone through the battle to get with Dean, and we were building it, that a number of things had happened in my life. And I was looking for a change, and Dick said, well, why don't you come and run the club? And it all fell into place.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, just to retract, I mean, back, just to go back to that first meeting there, and just a quick snapshot of 1996, because at that particular moment in time, the whole country was kind of in thrall to football. We just had Euro 96. England had done remarkably well, and everyone was getting back into football again. And also, you know, Britpop was at its peak and the internet was still in its infancy. So there was, you know, everything was all had to be done by fax. Emails were only just coming into existence. So everything was, the world was so different. I mean, it was only like 24, 23 years ago, Martin, but the world was such a different place. So, I mean, how difficult was it to get everything moving back then?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, we had a fax machine in the office at Queen's Road, and we even had a fax machine in the office at North Road when we moved into the offices there, because that's when the decision was faxed through to us, if you remember. So email and scanning documents and sending them electronically, you know, didn't exist. I mean, the whole of business operated. I mean, when I started 57 years ago, we had the telex, used to send signals to other parts of your business by telex. It's quite extraordinary how things have changed, but Zoom and podcasts, I mean, my goodness, what are they? And here we are, that we use them every day.
Podcasts are so, when you get, a bunch of blokes who have an issue that they want to, they don't just sit down in the pub, they'll make a podcast about it. That's just the way of modern living. So, you know, the World News Wife's got a podcast, but hey, we were here 13 years ago. So all you young presenters,
It's a good job that we're a radio show first and foremost, isn't it?
Well, we are.
You said you just wanted to build a stadium, you didn't want to run the football club, but you've done a successful job of both. It's been quite the journey. How do you quantify it? Because I mean, obviously, from being just a fan, I mean, I wouldn't have the first idea of how to run a book.
Well, you struggle with Lego, mate. So I wouldn't worry about that. But I think
I've got a degree in Lego.
Yeah, I think what Adi's trying to say is that can you believe that from that first day, admittedly with a background knowledge of, hard construction and stadium construction and what have you, that from there to where we are now. I think his point is that it must feel like now it's gone like in a blink of an eye.
Well, yeah, remember that I was, by that time, you know, I'd become a director of a business. And at the end of the day, you have to run a football club like a business. It's got some extraordinary features in it. I mean, the fan ownership of their business is really, really important, and woe betide anybody who doesn't understand that. It is like operating in a goldfish bowl, because absolutely every decision you make, every move you make, is analysed to the nth degree, both by the fans and by the press. You are very much in the public domain, everything that you do. So it is different from that point of view, but there is a team of people, a multidisciplinary team of people. You know, I mean, I inherited, you know, the club secretarial side, which was Derek Allen. There's a finance side. When I inherited it, there was virtually nothing in terms of commercial or marketing. Remember, at Gillingham, we had a few very, very loyal sponsors, but our connection with the business community was virtually zero. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are the external stakeholder relationships with people like, as I said, the council, ultimately the universities, as well as other members of the community. So, you know, those features of it are not that dissimilar from running any other sort of business. But of course, it's your whole of your business plan. It really revolves around what happens on the pitch on a Saturday afternoon, and if that doesn't go right, you take the consequences. So you had to deal with it.
When you started at the club, though, Martin, I mean, you not only that, all the things you're talking about, you're also sort of, you know, going into work not physically every day like this, but you know, you all had to operate with one hand or one arm, one leg tied behind your back because the appalling PR that you and Dick and Bob had inherited, but for, you know, the extra £500,000 bond, which I don't think exists today. I mean, you know, just like any Tom, Dick and Harry run a club nowadays, without having to go through the hoops that you've been through. You know, so even starting from the very bottom, there's almost, you know, this thing from within the industry that was actually trying to stop you from making the progress that you needed to make.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. There were, you know, countless hurdles to face. But as I've said many times before, I suppose I had this vision that we could do it. I knew what we wanted to achieve. I never gave up. No matter what was thrown at us, we found a way through it. And those hurdles, you know, there were financial ones. I can remember standing in my kitchen crying with the person who actually did become my wife. and saying, I do not know how we are going to pay the wages at the end of this week. I can remember that moment. She can remember it. And somehow or other, Dick pulled another rabbit out of the hat, and we had the money and we got through it. And we had all of the setbacks that we faced, and we just kept going. It was just sheer bloody mindedness.
I mean, it occurs to me that anyone under the age of 35 wasn't there. I mean, anyone under the age of 40 was going to struggle to remember. Anyone under the age of 35 wasn't there. And they can see, where things are rosy in the garden, because, you know, we're still sort of trying to build a platform for our Premier League, and hey, the Premier League, as opposed to where we were. But for those younger ones who are listening, give a flavour of just how precarious. Certainly by the time we got back to With Dean, I mean, never mind Gillingham, but by the time we got back to With Dean, how precarious with trying to run a stadium that only held 8,000 people while trying to get the stadium through City Hall and what have you, you know. give us a flavour of day-to-day living with Dean in Porter Cabin City.
Well, as you say, the situation was probably most precarious at Gillingham because attendance has dropped to an average of what, just over 2,000. And we simply were running out of money. And it was, and as you say, to even keep the club, keep its membership in the Football League, we had to put up £500,000 in cash, actually, because there was no other way of doing it, to the Football League, just to allow for the pleasure of continuing in the league, while we got back to Brighton, and we were given 3 years to get back. Otherwise, that money would have been taken from us. Now, we did it in two. Which was very, very fortunate. But at the same time, we were leeching money, and any money that Dick had put in was just disappearing fast. So we had to do two things. We had to bring other people in, and this is really one of Dick's huge skills, was to identify people who would be willing to assist us. And you know a number of them. There were people like Derek Chapman, Ray Bloom, and others who helped us out. And we used to, nowadays we hold board meetings on a very regular basis, and they're very formal affairs, and there's a very clear agenda, everybody, you know, produces their board reports, etc. In those days, we used to call a board meeting when we were short of money.
And I'm daily.
I'm quite literally, and I'm quite sure the directors at that time, their hearts sank, because if Dick rang up and said, need a board meeting, they actually knew that what it meant was he was going to, send round the begging bowl, and he wanted them to put in some more money. And that really, literally, was it was hand-to-mouth. Not only were we running the football club, remember, we were funding a massively expensive planning application process. So how we did it, just when you look back, you think, my goodness, how did we do it?
I mean, very much. You said the phrase I was going to use myself, which was the hand-to-mouth existence, and you said on the official Albion podcast about the help that you got from people like Norman Cook and things. But also there was the Alive and Kicking campaign that was going at that particular time, and basically the support, we all came together. It was such a big family at that particular moment in time. More so than it is now, probably, because it needed to be, because everyone was all pulling in the same direction. With that in mind, obviously, I mean, how much help did Norman actually give you? Because obviously there was the shirt sponsorship, but he was helping pay some of the wages, I believe, as well.
Well, I'm not going to go into the actual detail, but he provided financial support at an absolutely vital time. I mean, you're absolutely right. It was the support that we got in every direction, from the fans, from people buying season tickets. That was absolutely vital to us. As well as the support that we were given by both the benefactors and the directors at that time, just kept us alive.
Okay, well, I mean, I've got to fast forward it on to the current day then, Martin. Obviously, back then we were strapped with cash; things were very, very difficult. How do you think the club would have coped if you threw coronavirus into the mix? Like, as
well, you've got to
one team now have to.
You've got to realise the impact that this is coronavirus is having. I mean, first of all, you haven't got the income from ticket sales. You haven't got the income from things like catering and all of that, and I feel for Tony, because Tony, you know, has made this unbelievable investment in the football club. It is the football club that we've got today is because of Tony Bloom. Mm-hmm. And here he is being hit again by the losses that will occur as a result of the COVID crisis. And don't forget, it has affected TV revenues, it's affected ticket income and all these other income streams. I mean, again, there are a large number of fans that have, you know, left their money in or whatever over this period, and the club is exceptionally grateful to them for that, for their generosity, and that's absolutely fantastic. But you know, the brunt of this will be borne by Tony, and it's true of all the clubs. I mean, you know, the campaign that is running at the moment to get fans back into the stadium, it's absolutely vital that we get fans back in. And frankly, it's a complete nonsense to allow, you know, a load of people into the Royal Albert Hall indoors to watch a concert, and not allow fans into stadiums to watch their football team outside in the open air. I mean, it just does not make sense. It has got to change, frankly, because it is hitting the Premier League clubs really hard. It's hitting the Football League clubs even harder, because of course the ticket income for a Football League club makes up a much greater proportion of their income. So it is really, really hurting them. And this government somehow has got to get the message, we've got to get fans back into the stadium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, this show is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Over 100,000 shirts of varying hues and colours and designs. All for your
country.
Go on there, have a look. And, it's amazing. As usual, Phil has given us a shirt of the week, which Martin's got there to have a look at. Martin, can you describe this particular chemise de jour for me?
Well, first of all, the principal colours are black and white. It's a black and white, it looks like a black and white hoop rather than a black and white stripe. With the main body of the shirt is white. Am I allowed to mention the sponsor on the front?
The BBC.
With Tunstall Assurance on the front.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you recognise this shirt, basically?
Do I recognise it?
Yeah.
I don't recognise it as a shirt, but I guess, bearing in mind where Tunstall come from, it's probably going to be Port Vale, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You've got it in one. And this is what Shelley from oldfootballshirts.com has to say about this particular shirt. He said, this is the 2001 to 2003 home shirt of Burslem's Valiants, Port Vale. I chose this shirt as this was the kit that Port Vale wore when Brighton played the last game of the 2001 to 2002 season. We're already champions, and towards the end of the second half, I recall Martin Perry and Dick Knight appearing to my left-hand side and then watching the remainder of the game on the terrace with the fans. Can you remember who scored Brighton's winner that day, Arsenal?
Yes, I can.
I can too.
It was Paul Watson, a free kick that evaded everyone.
It was great. And we were wearing red shorts that day, which threw everybody.
Black and red shirts, red shorts. Well, they were wearing black shorts, so...
Yeah.
Well, didn't the fans sing to Brian Houghton, you should have joined a big club, or should have stayed with a big club?
You're right, Martin, I'd forgotten that. Well played, I'd forgotten that.
Dick and I were in the away end with the supporters, and it was great fun. I remember it vividly.
I remember it because you were rocking a very strange combo of of a suit and tie with a shirt over the top of the suit and tie.
Well, that was because I was going to try, and in fact I did succeed in getting into the boardroom after the game. In particular, I wanted to go and see Brian, who's always remained a very good friend of mine.
Don't let it ever be said that me or Aidy ever lead the charge when it comes to sartorial elegance. But there are two particular looks that you have perfected, Martin, that I think we can call them. Well, one we can call them Martin. There's certainly the Austin Powers look, which you've got down to a T, which I think is probably...
Thank you.
Listen to the Albion podcast, because that gives Martin... So we don't have to embarrass Martin again. I mean, we could lay it on thick, but let's not. But the other one is that look of football shirt over city suit. It is quite a look you've perfected, Martin.
Well, I sort of have to perform two roles. I want to show that I'm a Brighton supporter, but I also, you know, I have to comply with the dress code if I want to get into the boardroom in these various places.
It's like a
combination of the two.
It's a version of the mullet, isn't it? It is a mullet.
It's football shirt under the suit, not over it.
Yeah. But it is, you know, the classic description of a mullet is like a party at the back, business at the front. It's, you know...
It's a little bit, yeah, but I don't even accuse Martin Perry of having a mullet. I mean, that is taking a big
part. Oh, back in the 70s, probably, though.
Did you want to talk about AITC?
I do want to just... I'm not going to go through all of this, but I mean, Phil's given me quite a big blurb on that portfolio.
Well, sometimes we don't start singing Robbie
Williams. But I'm not going to go through all of that. But, I mean, there are a few players which I just wanted to go through here that have worn both the Port Vale and Albion colours, which Phil's given us. He's obviously gone to a lot of research to do this. So, Russell Brummidge, who only actually played about three games for us, yet he turns out for our
he's the one who, once upon a time, he used to organise the Albion Old Boys team.
Yeah. So but, you've got Brian Horton, Jeff Minton, Calvin Andrew, Doug Loft, Billy Painter, Mark Chamberlain, Tony Rougier, and Chris Birchall. Chris also holds Port Vale's record for the most capped international player, with 44 appearances for Trinidad and Tobago. And this is a message from Phil to you, Martin. He'd like to pass on his and Louise's best wishes and thanks for everything you've done for the club. And I'm sure all of our listeners will echo that sentiment.
But thank now, you very
much. It says here that you've retired, but you're still very much involved with AITC, I believe. You've just, AITC today just announced the Albion Challenge. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, yes, I've been asked to continue as chairman of Albion in the Community. And fortunately, the trustees voted for it. So I am going to continue in that role, which is a role that I love. And I'm really happy to be doing that, because the impact that AITC has on the local community is absolutely incredible. I've overseen it from, you know, its tiny, tiny beginnings to what it is today. So I'm honoured and privileged and delighted to be carrying on in that role for the foreseeable future. Yes, AITC has announced its Albion Challenge today. The issue for us through the COVID crisis is that, of course, again, we have lost a lot of income, particularly from the fundraising events. I mean, the annual features were the annual golf day, participation in the Brighton Marathon, the 10K, and of course, with those events not happening, we've lost large chunks of that fundraising income, which is very important to us. So the charity has come up with the idea of launching a scheme where a bit like the London Marathon at the weekend, you do it in your own home, you do it locally, and you submit evidence of your what you've achieved, and they've done it by setting challenges that you can walk, cycle, push, whatever it is, to another Premier League club. And of course, the closest one is Crystal Palace. I think that's 42 miles, and the furthest one is Newcastle, which I forget. It's about 370 miles, isn't it, or something?
326.
326. So you know, and you don't have to do it all in one day. You can do it over a series of days, so you can or weeks or whatever. You can get on your bike, as long as you can provide evidence that you've actually done it. Then you'll get your certificate. But you know, it is vital for the charity that we continue to find ways of raising money to keep it going. It's a vital part of our income. And if people can have fun undertaking this challenge, then we would love supporters to sign up to it.
Very quickly, how do they do that?
I've got the blurb here, Al, actually. Participants had the choice of completing a distance equivalent of going from the Amex to another designated Premier League ground, and the distance can be covered by running, walking, cycling, swimming, or even pushing.
I think Martin's just said that.
The distance can be covered by participants in their own time, but must be completed between now and by the time Big Ben strikes midnight on the 31st of December. The distance can also be tracked on your own personal fitness tracker and downloaded upon completion. The distance is to choose from are the Amex to Selhurst Park, as Martin correctly said, 42 miles, Amex to Tottenham Hotspur, 57 miles, Amex to the King Power Stadium, 144 miles, Amex to Old Trafford, 227, and Amex to St James's Park, 326. Entry costs £10, and every person who raises over £50 in sponsorship for AITC will receive a specially designed Albion Challenge medal. Full details of this are obviously on the Albion website, and please go along and take part. I'm going to have a go at that myself. I'm not going to swim to St James's Park, though. I will tell you that now.
I can vouch for that. Martin, let's take you back a few years to the days when you were allowed to smoke indoors. You're allowed to smoke, for that matter. When I'm talking about this, there's probably a couple of characters that spring to mind here. So with that in mind, and again, it's something that was raised on the Albion podcast, but you never really got into it, is the Farmer for All Committee. Now, you said that on that podcast you had a hoot, you had a laugh, and there were some very diverse characters, from probably at one end, Liz Costa and Sarah Watts, to at the other end,
Paul Welsh,
Attila, and you had Paul Samra trying to keep order. Give us a flavour of a classic textbook Falmer for All meeting. And let's start with Dick was late when?
Every time. we used to call him the late Dick Knight. Dick was not capable of turning up at any meeting on time. I don't think it ever achieved. That ever happened. But the meetings always used to take place in the evenings, after work. The members of the Falmer for All campaign used to come in from their work. I mean, the amount of time that they spent on it was just astonishing, really. And as you say, you had this complete diverse range of characters. And Paul Samra used to try to keep the peace between them all. I used to always tell a story at the beginning, and usually it was a rant about somebody who'd done something that had upset me. Dick used to give a bit of an update, perhaps on things that were happening in the club. There was a real understanding between us that what we said and talked about in those meetings would not go beyond those four walls. And in fairness to them, they really did, honour that confidentiality, and nothing leaked, which was fantastic, because it meant that we could be really open with them about what the issues that we were facing and how we were dealing with it. And they were very helpful. And you know, we used to discuss the various approaches to what we were doing, and we had a lot of fun because the campaign, particularly the Falmer for All campaign, was a lot of it was based on humour, which was absolutely the right thing to do. I mean, we got John Prescott's sense of humour and he got ours.
Sure.
And it struck a chord. And he very kindly put a tribute to me in the Manchester United program recently. He said how to a man and a woman, every Albion fan that he met was charming, polite, and funny.
With good reason, to be fair.
Pardon?
With good reason, to be fair.
Yeah, but I mean, bear in mind at the time, you know, there were other political lobbying campaigns going on. There was the Labour Party conference when Countryside Alliance, you know, dumped a dead horse outside Brighton Station, which was pretty horrific. Do you remember the flower throwing incident in the House of Commons that scared everybody? There was people climbed onto the roof of John Prescott's house. Those sort of really scary, frightening types of campaign, actually, every time that happened, I loved it because I knew that our campaign was funny. It was, it caught attention, and people loved it. And they said, "Fair enough, you know, people have the right to lobby, but do it in a way that doesn't." Upset people, and we got the tone of it absolutely spot on.
I think so.
Like, you know, and those meetings, a lot of time used to be spent. People like Bill Swallow was an absolute genius at coming up with funny lines, with captions to pictures. It was just hilarious, some of it, and they were great fun, but very, very positive. With, as you said earlier, everybody pulling hard in the same direction, cool. And that was the key to it.
What was your favourite campaign, Martin?
Well, the flowers were really funny because Richard Hebbard at the time thought he ought to ring up John Prescott's security officer and just say, look, I mean, you know, don't take too much notice of this. There are going to be some bunches of flowers arriving for John. You know, we want you to pass them on to St Thomas's Hospital when you've finished with them. And the response came back: flowers. We've been flooded with flowers and chocolates all bloody morning. You know, I mean, it was just. But I suppose the one that I loved the most was the funniest. Would had to be. The spoof menu at the Liberal Party conference when we all dressed up in black tie and didn't have a football shirt over the top and handed out menus, these spoof menus to the Liberal Party conference delegates as they went into their dinner in the pavilion. And some people thought we were waiters. And when they read the menu, there were things like Baker's Krusty Rolls. I mean, it was just hilarious.
Cabinet so very wrong.
It's a good job that menu isn't going now because it would just say gammon, gammon, gammon,
yeah, well,
gammon.
There is that. But I've got to ask this of you, Martin. Now, over this past couple of weeks or so, people have been quite rightly paying sort of very generous tributes to you, and we're going to be doing so presently again in a moment. But as you've said many times, this has always been a collaborative effort. So, I mean, I just always think in times like this of people who didn't make it this far, who didn't make it to the Premier League, who didn't even make it to Falmer. So if it's all right with you, Martin, can you just give us a quick word about the likes of Ed Basford and Paul Welsh and Sarah Watts and so on?
Well, you know, how sad it is that they didn't see us get into the Premier League. But they played such an important part. They were key figures in that in that Farmer for All campaign, all three of them, and they were lovely people. They were totally dedicated to Brighton and Hove Albion. The time that they dedicated to it was just extraordinary. They were completely reliable, and they have left us a wonderful legacy for what they did. So, you know, our hearts go out to their families. You know, and losing them, almost all of them, all three of them, at a very young age, really. And we should always be forever grateful to them for what they did, because it just could not have been done without their support. I'm so grateful to them, and remember them so fondly for the way that they the things that they did.
Sure, I think every Brighton fan who certainly knows them, and everyone who has an understanding of the history of the past 25 years, I think will echo that. So, but talking of memory, time to test your Martin. You might think you've hit 73, but Aidy just said, look, you know, ask Martin 10 quick questions, see what he can remember about what's happened at the Albion since 1996. But most of the stuff is not going to be online, but let's see what you can remember.
And bearing in mind, nothing was online in 1996, really, Al, so there you go.
Yeah, I know. Right, okay, question one. Which number one single, released shortly before you met Dick, Bob, Liam, etc., returned to the number one spot 2 years ago?
Oh, my goodness me.
I think I know this one.
What came to... I haven't got a clue.
Go on, Three Lions.
It is Three Lions.
Three Lions, all right.
Okay, see if you can remember this then, seeing as I know you were there.
I'm not going to get many of these right, am I?
Not as such, no. Who scored the first and the last goal for Brighton at With Dean? Two names I want here.
The first goal? Was that Darren Freeman?
It was, well done. And the last one?
The last one.
Was this the last Brighton goal? Or last?
Yeah, last Brighton goal at With Dean. I suspect you were drunk at the time because we...
I probably was.
...celebrate winning. I mean,
it was Gus Poyet's team.
Yes.
Can't remember.
188.
God, we lost 3-1 to Southampton, didn't we?
No, I don't think you're going to get this. It was
go on.
2 at home to Huddersfield. It was Matt Sparrow.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, what was based at the place with the postcode BN11YR?
That wasn't our offices, was it?
Yes, it was. Well done.
Yeah. God, I don't remember the YR bit.
this one you should get.
That's because everything went in there by fax, Martin.
Well, all right. You can get those. Yeah. Edit out that bit and just say, I'll say our offices.
What were the names of the two inquiry inspectors who rejected Falmer as a viable site?
John Collier, yeah. And Hoyle. Can't remember his first name, but it was Hoyle.
Charles Hoyle.
Charles Hoyle.
Yes. I knew that those names would be imprinted on your mind.
Mm.
Okay, two names here. Who was the leader and who was the deputy leader of the Seagulls party?
The leader? Ed Basford stood as the candidate. Tim Carter, I think Tim Carter was the agent. The leader and deputy leader, was Paul Samron one of those?
Are you asking me? Yeah, Paul Samron was the leader. Who was the deputy leader?
Yeah, was it Sarah?
No, it was Adrian Newnham.
Oh, right, yeah.
Right, now then, slightly embarrassing, but I'm going to ask you in a way. For what reason did you make a public apology to Charlie Oakway and Paul Rogers at a fans' public meeting?
Did I really? That was a mistake. I haven't got a clue. Why did I do that?
It's because they spent one time training at Preston Park because nowhere else was available. And you actually said that.
Right. Yeah, that was Mickey Adams trying to draw attention to the state of the pitch at
the state of the club, yeah.
at Sussex University. Yeah. Right. Did I do that publicly? You did. It was right.
You publicly apologised to them. I think, which is actually a very gracious and dignified thing to do.
Whether Charlie understood
what you were saying, I don't know. But what was the name of the goalkeeper against whom you scored in the sod-cutting ceremony at Falmer?
It was a glorious morning. The sun was shining.
I scored two top bins. I know that.
He'd played the previous night in goal for us in Shrewsbury in the JPT.
He also wrote Only Fools and Horses.
Who wrote Only Fools and Horses? Can't remember.
It was John Sullivan.
What was the name? There's only two to go now. What was the name of the Withdean resident who took the council and the club to court over the Albion's presence there?
John Catt.
Yeah, another one who's imprinted on your mind.
He was brilliant.
What was claimed to take 25 minutes, but in reality took most people about 55 minutes?
It was 56 minutes, and it was the walk from Brighton Station to Sheepcote Valley.
Brilliant. There you go. It might be 73, but you know his IQ is bigger than that.
It's good, but I mean, it was. You know, I mean, all of those things, though. I mean, it was like particularly stuff involving Ed Bassett as well. Bless him. Was I mean, Ed was so important, wasn't he?
Absolutely. But I mean, what it also shows, Martin, is the nature and the variety of what your work has had to entail, going from, you know, dealing with people who wanted to take you to court just for playing football to, you know, turning out on a muddy field to score a goal made out of bulldozers. I mean, it's been quite a 24 years. So I've got to ask you, as we're nearing the end of the show, if I can, to ask you to sum up what it has meant since that first time you came on board in 1996 until now, when Tony's finally released you back into the wild, what it has meant to you to do the job that you've done.
I sum it up as first of all, it's 23 years of my working career. My working career now spans 57 years, and 23 of that has been spent at the Albion. They are no doubt the happiest days that I have spent in my working life. They are the most rewarding, the most productive, the most fun. And I don't regret a single second of that time. And I don't regret that decision to step away from a mainstream job in a large company to come to the Albion to do the job that I did. I also feel massively privileged to have been part of what is a quite extraordinary story. When you look at the club that Dick, Bob and I inherited in 1997, and you look at it now, it is just unbelievable. It's two different clubs. You know, I leave it in a position where it's got... I would argue the strongest Albion team it's ever had. It's in its fourth year in the Premier League. It's certainly got the strongest management structure and ownership structure that it's ever had. And it's got the most amazing facilities, both in the stadium and in the training ground. Yeah. We inherited a club that was at the bottom of the Football League. It hung on by the skin of its teeth. We did not know where we were going to play in August when we took over the club in April. Yeah. That's the story. And to have been part of that story and have been able to be given the opportunity to play a part in that story has been an absolute honour and a privilege. And obviously, I will carry it with me for the rest of my days.
Okay, I want to ask the same question, but with a twist, Martin. But what does Brighton Hove Albion Football Club mean to you?
Brighton and Hove Albion Football Club is a family. It's a family of made up of players, staff, and supporters, and they all pull together, and they all benefit positively from their association with the club. It's a wonderful club. Its values are outstanding, and to be part of it as a supporter, as a member of the team that runs it, has been, you know, it is tremendous. And I just want to see it thrive and go on from strength to strength. And I'm sure it will, with the leadership that it's now got.
Thing is, if you know the song Nights in White Satin, which I'm sure you do because you are 73, then you know the line from it, "Letters I've written, never meaning to send." Well, I did actually write something, and I did mean to send it to you, but if I may, this is something on behalf of the Albion Rule, which Aidy has okayed, and I'd just like to say this to you, and I mean it with my heart. So, Martin, now that Tony has finally released you during this transfer window and allowed you to retire, we just wanted to send this note of thanks and appreciation for all your hard work these past 24 years. Make no mistake, every single Brighton & Hove Albion fan knows that without your Herculean and at times Sisyphean efforts, the Albion would not have been able to return to Brighton, to Withdean, and we certainly wouldn't have got Falmer. The thousands of hours of research, preparation, debating, presenting, justifying, under days of intense cross-examination, while canvassing, protesting, campaigning, and much more. And look at where this has taken us. We know what you did for us, and we are so grateful, as a community, as a city, and as a football club. More than that, you were gracious enough to take time out and talk with us on the Albion Roar, mostly with a sense of pride that you were achieving on behalf of the people of this brilliant city. For this and so much more, thank you for your time, effort, tenacity, strength, laughter, grumpiness, optimism, frustration, oh, those sodding bats, and all those other qualities needed to deliver the prize that we all wanted, needed, and deserved. We wish you a long and happy retirement. You've earned it. From Aidy, Alan, Phil at the Albion Roar.
Well, thank you so much. Those words are very kind and wonderful, and I am so grateful to you. I am so grateful to all of the fans for the support that they've given me over the years. I've absolutely loved it. I do just want to pay tribute just to one person, and that's my wife, who's been absolutely brilliant, and I've never really paid tribute to her. If I can just say thanks to Elwyn for all that she's done in supporting me, in enabling me to do what I did and what I achieved. I am so grateful to her. But to everybody, thank you so much for all you have done for me. And I wish you all well. I'm going to be coming to matches. I'm still part of AITC, and I will be following the club and its fortunes for many, many years to come, for the rest of my days. I will never forget any of you, because you have been absolutely amazing, and we could not have achieved it if we hadn't worked together as we did. So thank you all so much.
Just one last thing then. Viva el Vice Presidente! We'll be right back.